Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and our partners here at MSC Radio Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, Associate Director for the Institute, and I'm joined by Institute Director Mac Grossman and economist Dr. Charlie Ballard. Later on, we'll be joined by our guest, Dr. Noura Sadiq, an Assistant Professor of American Politics and Public Policy at Michigan State. We'll be discussing Dr. Sadiq's work in political behavior, race, and ethnic politics, especially as it pertains to Muslim Americans. Well, gentlemen, we haven't been here in a little while. So, Charlie, tell us, how's the economy doing?
Well, most economists, myself included, would say that the economy is doing pretty well. Job growth has far exceeded the expectations that we had from a year or more ago. Inflation is not completely extinguished, but it's way down from what it was a year and a half ago. Wages are growing faster than prices. So all of that is pretty good news. Interestingly, public opinion surveys or consumer sentiment surveys, one from the University of Michigan, one from the Conference Board, don't seem to reflect that good news nearly as much as we might have thought. A lot of people remain pretty grumpy in their assessment of the economy, even with a relatively good performance. A lot of ink has been spilled trying to explain that. One explanation is that a lot of the people who were in the survey, ordinary folks, they wouldn't, if I said, hey, look, inflation is way down, they would say, well, yeah, but eggs are still really expensive. And I think economists say we would like inflation, that is the rate of change of prices, to be small. But a lot of people say, well, unless prices go back to where they were 4 years ago, I'm not happy. So that's one thing. A second thing is that you and I, Arnold, we spent most of our life, we lived most of our life before the United States had a major economic catastrophe. And then we had one in 2008 with the financial crisis and another one in 2020 with the COVID shutdown. So people who are in their 20s and 30s, most of their life has been lived in this less certain environment. And so a lot of people, even if they say, well, yeah, I got a job, I can pay my bills, but there's kind of a long-term uncertainty, which, frankly, with the predictions that Social Security and Medicare will run out of money 10 years from now unless we change policies, and with a interest payments on the national debt soon to top $1 trillion a year, that there is some reason for kind of long-term uncertainty and worry. The other one is a phenomenon that really seems to have only shown up in the last decade or so, and it has to do with the partisan divide that Matt knows a lot about, especially in after the 2016 election. A lot of Democrats changed from saying the economy is good to the economy is bad almost overnight when Trump was elected. A lot of Republicans changed from saying the economy is lousy to the economy is great almost overnight. So clearly, some people, when you ask them, how's the economy, they're not really answering that question. They're answering, I'm glad that my guy is in the White House, or I'm sad that my guy is not in the White House, and that spills over into consumer sentiment assessments.
You know, you're talking about prices and how the everyday American views prices. I always consider one of the larger markers is gas prices. And right now, gas prices are headed upwards.
They had a long period of being very quiet, but recently they're up a lot. And gas prices really grab the public attention more than just about anything else, because it's the only thing that we regularly, twice on my drive into work,
yeah,
I see this gigantic sign saying with the price.
Right, yeah. So Matt, Charlie mentioned the partisan divide. This week it was announced that the Congress and the president have agreed to a long-term budget solution through the rest of the year.
Through the rest of the year.
Long term of 6 months.
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, we've been going month to month here.
By recent standards, 6 months is a long time.
You know, it's kind of like those 20-year-olds that only know, you know, a tough time, right? Our presidential election is set. Feels like Groundhog Day. How is the economy, do you think, how is the economy going to play a role moving forward? As we get into really campaign season?
Well, so far, Biden is getting the blame, but not the credit. So his approval rating declined as the economy got worse, but it has not been getting better as the economy has been getting better. Even when consumer sentiment has noticed the economic gains and has been rising, Biden approval has not been rising along with it. So it remains to be seen if he'll ever get an election year bump in approval. If he does not, you know, history would suggest he's on the road to losing. That is, his current approval is consistent with losing the national popular vote, which would mean losing the Electoral College, especially because it does look like Republicans are retaining a bit of an edge in the Electoral College, where they're ahead in the swing states a little bit more than in the national popular vote.
Let's talk about Biden's popularity for a second, because I've maintained for some time now that the National Democratic Party is only two steps behind the National Republican Party when it comes to being torn apart at the seams. And it seems as if that's starting to happen a little bit right now. And we'll talk more with Dr. Sadiq about the uncommitted vote. But it seems as this phenomena spreads across the country, there are others that are not only upset with the president's policy toward the Middle East, but there are now others that might be voting uncommitted that are upset that he hasn't moved far enough on civil rights, or that they feel the economy is bad. What do you think this means for the president moving forward? Do you see this having any kind of an impact as we move toward the Democratic convention and the general election?
Well, that would actually be better news for Biden. If the true problems are on his left, or people who think that he hasn't done enough so far, history suggests that by the time we get to November, they'll realize that they may not like Biden, but that Trump is worse on those same kinds of dimensions. But I don't actually buy the premise. I think that where Biden is weak is not really on the left. It is with traditional Democratic constituencies, like minority voters and young voters, but the people that he is losing or the people who are undecided are actually on the more conservative side of those subgroups. So instead, a lot of what's going on is that these social ties, which normally make even conservative-leaning minority voters and young voters vote for the Democrats, have not kicked in. And instead, they're leaning towards the Republicans so far this year.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, because I did see a couple of articles this past week talking about minority voters and how they're moving to the right, African-Americans, Latinos in particular. Why do you think that is? What's causing that?
Well, everyone moves to the right slightly under Democratic presidencies, and so I wouldn't say that they're disproportionately moving right. It's more that we had a very long period in which white voters divided based on ideology and issue preferences, and minority voters had not really divided based on those preferences as much. And now they are dividing along similar lines as white voters. And what that means is that if you have a constituency that's voted 90 or 70% Democratic, that it had traditionally been including some voters who actually agreed more with Republicans on the overall role of government and direction of society. So that is worse news for Biden than your story. If your story is right, then he can win back some of those voters, because all they have to do is remind people that, well, actually, you may think that Biden is not good on Israel, but Trump is going to be worse on that same dimension, according to you, same on economic policy or other preferences. But But if it's my story, it's a little bit harder to imagine winning those people back, especially when people's views of the candidates are so set. People aren't paying much attention. So once they pay attention, they may learn new things. But these are the same guys. And the main thing that is different about it this time is that Biden is a lot less popular than he was. And Trump is, if anything, slightly more popular than he was.
See, and you, I hearken back to 2016 when those that were not happy with then presidential candidate Hillary Clinton either sat out or did a protest vote. And if I'm a Democrat, I'm concerned about that again, that those that you say that, you know, Biden's not very popular right now. And so that concern, if I'm a Democrat, that concerns me that those that will have a repeat scenario of 2016 where those uncommitted will either sit out the election or vote for a protest candidate.
Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer that there was a big people sitting out on the left in 2016. It actually was no bigger than, say, the percentage of Hillary Clinton voters who were mad about Barack Obama winning the primary and didn't vote Democratic in the 2008 election. So it was a pretty normal degree of losing part of the Democratic constituency in 2016. That really wasn't where the move was. It was more, again, in the middle.
On the issue of social conservatism, the State of the State survey, the survey that we run through the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, on several occasions in the last decade or so has asked questions about LGBTQ rights. And while the public generally has moved toward more favorable toward LGBTQ, a very notable exception was that black respondents to our survey were much less sympathetic to gays and lesbians mm-hmm. than their white counterparts, all else equal. And that may be one of the things that's showing up in the conservative drift of minority voters. Another point worth making, of course, is that an awful lot of Americans don't like either Joe Biden or Donald Trump. I was at an event in Jackson County a couple of weeks ago, and somebody asked me about the election, and I kind of hemmed and hawed and said various things. But then I finally came up with a line that was wildly popular. I said, "I'm really looking forward to the 2028 election." Well, people really cheered when they heard that.
We've talked a bit about the national scene. Let's bring it back down to Michigan. Politically, the Michigan House of Representatives has been tied for a few months now at 54-54. Not much has really been done there. We have special elections coming up for two of those Democratic districts. And Matt, we also, you did a lot of work on and with the Redistricting Commission. And it seems like now people are starting to sign off. The special master that the court had appointed this week signed off on the map, even though there are still some that are upset that it protects incumbents, but that was not the issue at hand. Is the map that the commission approved a couple of weeks ago, you think that's going to be the map?
I think it's likely to be. The court still has to weigh in and approve it, but all of the indications that they're getting are pretty positive about the map. And those people who don't like it still like it better than the previous map. So,
and is it a better map?
I think overall, certainly when it comes to African-American representation, it is a better map. It's also a better map in just the way that it looks and corresponds to how people think about their neighborhoods and areas, whereas the previous map had a bunch of French fry style districts going in and out of Detroit. This one makes more sense.
Well, the court needs to act quickly. We have filing deadlines that are coming up, and those folks running for office certainly need to know the lines.
And this will be only part one because the commission still has to redo the Senate districts as well, but they have a lot longer to do that.
Yeah, they have a couple more years actually to put that in.
Shout out to my colleague John Aguilla, who put a lot of work in and I think played a real role in helping to frame those new districts.
Yeah, John and Matt and Ipser and even our colleagues down at the University of Michigan also worked with the commission along the way. And I think at the end of the day, despite the fits and starts, the independent commission still proved its worth. And, you know, no one said this was going to be a perfectly clean process. It's certain, like I said, to me, it's had its fits and starts, but I think we've got a model that'll work.
There's simply no way to draw a set of districts that that is perfect by every criterion. And so you're always going to have people who will be grumpers. But for me, it's a vast improvement over what we had before.
So let's get a little bit about Michigan politics. What about the Michigan economy, Charlie? I know we talked about the national economy. Michigan economy, you know, helps drive that and is impacted by that. Efforts are still underway to work to diversify the Michigan economy. We've still got a couple of large battery plants that are supposed to go in. Where are we in Michigan?
You know, I think in Michigan we're in a place that's not dramatically different from where we've been for the last many decades. Michigan was phenomenally successful in the middle decades of the 20th century with an economy based largely on manufacturing. The relative shrinkage of manufacturing in general and autos in particular has been hard for us, and so we have grown less rapidly than much of the rest of the nation for a long time, and that trend has continued. We have recovered very substantially from the COVID, but not as much as the rest of the country. And our population has remained fairly flat. Our employment has not grown as rapidly as that of the rest of the country. So how are we doing? Well, we're doing okay, you know. But we have fallen relatively. In the 50s, Michigan was in the top 10 in per capita personal income. And as recently as 2004, we were 21st. We're now 39th. That doesn't mean this is a poor place, although I will say almost all of the good news that comes in in the Michigan economy is either in northwestern Lower Peninsula, Traverse City, Leelanau, or it's in the southern half of the Lower Peninsula. The UP has fewer people now than it had in 1910. So if there's going to be growth, it's probably going to be south of the line from Saginaw to Ludington, or it's going to be up around Traverse City.
Yeah. And, you know, as we move forward here into the spring, the state budget's going to be coming up. The governor's got some proposals in there that are going to be worth watching as well. So it's going to be an interesting spring. Especially as we get two Democrats back in the office. But now let's welcome Dr. Sadiq to the program. As I noted, Dr. Sadiq is a professor of American politics and public policy at Michigan State University. A good part of her work has focused on Muslim American political behavior. Certainly, the recent presidential primary in Michigan brought that to the forefront. Dr. Sadiq, can you discuss your work in this area and provide us and our audience with some insight and perspective?
Sure. Muslim Americans are a pretty old community, particularly in the Midwest, in Michigan and Ohio. They've been around and invested since the early 1900s, but they've had generally like lower levels of political power and began to get more politically organized, I would say, in the years after 9/11, really realizing the need to become more politically engaged. But they've been really invested in the local economies in the area. And so my curiosity in sort of doing this work was seeing what motivates folks to get so involved in politics in a time when they're facing very targeted discrimination. Yet, even in the midst of targeted discrimination, folks are still trying to get involved on a local, state, and federal level in politics.
And now, you know, here in Michigan, and our audience knows this well, we have a very large Arab and Muslim population. I think the largest outside of the Middle East.
Is
that right?
Yep.
Can you talk about their growth in this area a little bit in the state and how, given what we saw in the presidential primary, they're starting to flex a little muscle, I think some would say.
Yes, there's a new generation that's really sort of, I would say that in the 90s, apparently, you know, the older generation was getting sort of involved and having conversations, but the younger generation that we see now holding sort of local office and federal office have been organizing the last 20 years in meaningful ways. And I think a lot of it's because they've been really committed to making Michigan better. And I think in a lot of ways, their families were small business owners and sort of invested in the economy. And they realized that, you know, in order for that to translate in a way that makes sense, you know, and getting involved in politics mattered, particularly in terms of ensuring that they weren't being systemically profiled and, you know, allowing people to see the nuances in their communities. You know, Arab Americans in Michigan include Christian Arabs, Chaldeans from Iraq, mm-hmm. in addition to folks from Yemen and Lebanon in terms of ancestry, and also a new resurgence of folks that were leaving war conflict in Syria and Iraq. So it's a pretty diverse community, but, you know, they have some shared experiences. And I think that's really informed how they're approaching politics, particularly in this past year where they realized that, you know, they have concerns with certain some of our foreign policy decisions, but their voices aren't being heard.
Mm-hmm. And also, even at the local level, we've seen some impact. Some of the issues regarding various books in public schools has also been an issue in, I believe, the Dearborn area, where we saw Muslim Americans also have some issues with that. So, and locally, we also have now our first Arab American mayor in Dearborn, Hamtramck itself. I mean, these are communities. I mean, Dearborn was well known, you know, in the latter part of the last century as being an Italian community, mm-hmm. Hamtramck mostly a Polish community.
Yep.
And now you go to both of those communities, Hamtramck probably one of the most diverse cities in our state, if not in our country.
That's right. And I think in that way, if you walk through Hamtramck, you see, you know, restaurants and signs and from folks that originate from Bangladesh and in Arabic. So it's like a multitude of different mm-hmm. communities that they all share the same faith, but they come from different parts of the world. But that's what's interesting, that on a local level, I think they have the room to sort of express some of their more socially conservative values when it came to sort of their concerns about what's going on and what books to have in their schools and in the area. But on a national level, their interests change, because I think on a national level, what they align with aligns more with the Democratic Party. So this is a community where in some ways, ostensibly, if they're more religiously practicing, you would suspect that they might sort of align with folks that might be more part of the Republican Party. But given sort of the issues with civil rights and civil liberties, they sort of flock to the Democratic Party.
Right. And so we were talking earlier about some of the constituency groups within the Democratic Party. And I think that Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, along with what we're seeing with Latino Americans and African Americans, socially liberal, but maybe culturally conservative.
Right.
And so now there's this push and pull between those two, and it's kind of reflected itself in the uncommitted vote. I mean, it started over what's going on in the Middle East, but I'm gathering that it's gaining steam again with others who are not happy with some of the other president's policies of the president.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, the issue of sort of the civilian crisis in Gaza, yeah. and it has been forefront. It's almost turned folks into single issue voters in an area where they're usually not single issue voters. You know, again, a lot of these folks are small business owners. They have concerns about, you know, their beliefs with economic policy. But this year, sort of, if you ask folks, everyone knows someone who has lost several members of their family in their community. And so that they're in a lot of ways, they're grieving, and that sort of turned them into like single issue voters and really propelled the uncommitted vote in a way that, you know, their goal was to have the uncommitted box checked off by 10,000 Michigan voters, and they reached about 100,000, so tenfold from their initial goal. Mm-hmm. And in a matter of weeks, propelled a movement that then sort of had a domino effect. And you see, you know, other states like Minnesota and Washington sort of picking up and being inspired to sort of do the same. So in a way to strategically show, like, to the Democrats, don't take our vote for granted. You know, we want you to pay attention to our issues.
Now, Matt, from a political perspective, I guess I have to ask you, it's going to make a difference?
Well, I guess what I would ask, Nora, is a lot of the attention has been on people objecting to Biden's policies sort of from the left. But, you know, the alternative that's out there in the 2024 campaign is Donald Trump. On the other hand, as Arnold said, there might be some, you know, history even in the last 2022 election of Dearborn voters swinging right when other people were swinging to the left. So I guess which, if any, is a threat to Biden? Losing supporters who agree with the Democrats on most things but are very upset over Gaza, or people who maybe are more swing voters but have traditionally supported the Democrats?
So I think in that way, the interesting thing is if you look at, like, the voter data on Arab Americans or Muslims, a high percentage say that they're independents, even though they'll vote Democrat at the polls. If you look at even, like, the Detroit Arab American study in 2003 or recent polling I did in 2019 and in 2023, it's interesting they don't have, like, a strong partisan identity. And so in a lot of ways, it kind of falls into two buckets because they think of themselves as a swing voter, that my vote is kind of, you know, I might swing the other way if the conditions align. But what's interesting is this is where you see the diversity of the Muslim community. Black Muslims are saying we're not leaving Biden. They developed a new collective called the Black Muslim Leadership Collective, and then they started this initiative just about 2 weeks ago in Philadelphia, where they're like, yes, we want to hold President Biden and the Democrats accountable, but not at the expense of having Trump back in office. So in a lot of ways, as Black Americans, they're really aligning with other Black Americans beyond Muslims because they're so fearful of a Trump presidency. And you see a variance with non-Black Muslims where some are like, I'm going to show up to vote and I'm going to ignore the presidential vote box. And some being like, is it going to get any worse? And sort of almost being okay with a Trump presidency. So there is a variance there that I was personally surprised by. You know, my hunch was that because Trump passed a Muslim ban that you would see more of a fear of him coming back to office. But Black Muslims feel that fear. But for non-Black Muslims, there's a variance.
And your research has also shown that some Muslims feel kind of a connection to the international Muslim community. And that has a big effect, I would imagine, on the extent to which Gaza is going to know, matter to their political participation. Is that something that's a big and rising factor?
Yes. So there's this term in Arabic called ummah, and it means community, collective community. And the sense or sort of sense of ummah consciousness is this concept that I've been studying in the last 20 years. And what we find is that folks, even if they're not religiously observant Muslims, even if they're Muslims that haven't never like stepped foot in a mosque, are feeling this sense of community to like this global Muslim community, this sense of solidarity and this sense of responsibility to sort of like help folks that they see as very vulnerable. And to me, that was a very interesting nuance, is that even folks I've interviewed that don't feel like they're necessarily welcome in mosques because they're very secular, you know, they may have grown up in a Muslim house, but they don't religiously observe, they feel this strong need to sort of, you know, help out as much as they can in this connection to this community. And so, and it's a lot of it's because the term ummah came to rise is in response to Muslim communities being subjugated. So the term itself sort of came into popularity, sort of the same way the Asian American identity came to popularity in Michigan after the death of Vincent Chin in 1984, is that there was this, you know, sense of like, we need to build a community. So the transnational connection is something that you ask a Muslim, whether they're religiously observant or not, they feel that sense of affinity to one another.
And that's, you know, and just think about what you said. I find it fascinating because you see that over time in various ethnic and cultural groups, right? This sense of community, especially when around the world, those that affiliate with that particular group feel like they're being subjugated, whether it's local, national, or international. So it's a definite social pattern that you see amongst ethnic, religious, and cultural groups along the way. Armenians, Jews, mm-hmm. all, you know, it's really fascinating that you see that happening across various groups.
But as you said, in Michigan, it's fairly unique in having a large Arab but not Muslim population.
Right. Yes.
How is that factoring in now? There have been some divisions in the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you might expect there to be some divisions based on this. On the other hand, maybe they're feeling that they're part of the group that is being persecuted as well.
I think if you were to say 20 years ago, you'd absolutely see, you know, more distinctions and, you know, people trying to say like, well, I'm part of this group and not that amongst Arab Americans. But now I think there's this sense of shared experiences and like a collective empathy in a way that we haven't seen in quite some time. And one of it's because, you know, whether you're Arab Christian or Arab Muslim, the post 9/11 surveillance strategies affected the entire community. So whether they wanted to be seen as connected to other Arabs or not, to the eyes of law enforcement, mm-hmm. they were. So that was like one reality that hit folks. And then the other is just, you know, this is affected Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims. And so this is seen as sort of like a cross-faith issue for Arab Americans. My dentist is Christian Lebanese, and I, you know, I was just getting my local cleaning done the other day, and the way he was talking about it, you would think I'm his niece. You know, he's like, we gotta, you know, really care for each other. And I was just getting this advice, you know, and it was very sweet, but it's just sort of like one anecdote about just the general expression of like shared affinity mm-hmm. across communities mm-hmm. at this mm-hmm. time.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly appreciate your work.
Thank you.
And I'm sure now that we know we have this resource here in you.
Yeah. Well, we'll be having at least one public event coming up in
yep.
May to celebrate the book in development. You want to give
yes.
one final pitch for that book in development?
So I have a book in development, and it's about beliefs that bind and looking at community-based religious beliefs amongst American Muslims and how that sort of has built this sense of Ummah that is very politically meaningful in terms of folks wanting to engage in politics and mobilize in ways because of this sense of responsibility they have. So I'm looking forward to sort of the conversation in May. And I think it'll have really, we've seen its impact in terms of the protests we've seen. And I think it'll translate electorally this coming mm-hmm. year. So it's mm-hmm. an interesting moment in time mm-hmm. to study Muslims, especially in Michigan.
Be careful. Russell will have you back on his own show coming up here in the future. So thank you very much for taking
yeah.
time.
Pleasure chatting.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I hope we can continue the conversation. Matt and Charlie, always a pleasure to be with you. Any final thoughts before we close this month?
Well, we're at the weekend where we have MSU women's basketball, MSU men's basketball, MSU gymnastics, and
ice hockey
all competing for championships. So go green.
Go white. All right. Very good. My thanks again to Russ White and his staff here at MSU Radio Studios for their support of this program. Join us again next month on State of the State.